on nuclear issues at all, you've undoubtedly heard the line, "Nobody died at Three Mile Island." It's a means of dismissing any concerns we might have about what happened because of that nuclear meltdown just outside Harrisburg, Pennsylvania in 1979. But then you hear an experienced researcher into nuclear health consequences say,
"The nuclear industry grabbed that slogan, 'Nobody died at Three Mile Island,' almost immediately after the meltdown occurred, before there had been any chance to measure how much radiation was released, how much actually got into the water and the food and people's bodies. It was an immediate attempt to stifle any type of research."
When you hear a genuine expert say something like that, you start to see how we've all been gamed when it comes to understanding nuclear dangers, and you start to realize that you are in the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Joseph Mangano, Executive Director of Radiation and Public Health Project, an expert researcher and epidemiologist whose examination of medical statistics in the areas around nuclear reactors reveal a much different picture of health impact than the nuclear industry wants you to know. Plus, we will have this week's nuclear news, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, a bit of duck and cover report for what's gone wrong at U.S. nuclear reactors, an important final thought revealing the truth of that lying phrase, "Nobody died at Three Mile Island," and more honest nuclear information than appeared last week in all media, broadcast or print, within a 50-mile radius of Three Mile Island. All of that coming up right now. Today is Tuesday, April 3rd, 2018, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off this week in Massachusetts, where the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station has remained shut for the 29th day in a row, as the Plymouth facility awaits the replacement of a transformer that delivers electricity to its auxiliary power system if the plant's main power generator goes offline. A spokesmodel for Entergy Corporation, the Louisiana-based company that owns the 46-year-old nuclear plant — these are words you never want to hear together because these facilities were only built to last for 40 years before being terminated. Anyway, a spokesperson for Entergy said that the date for when the plant returns to service is currently undetermined. The controversial nuclear power plant, which has a poor safety record and is acknowledged as one of the three worst-run nuclear facilities in the country by the NRC, was shut down on March 6 to allow for the repair of a leak in one of five water heaters that feed liquid into the reactor. The plant has remained offline through the March 13 nor'easter that brought high winds and heavy snow accumulation across the region. That storm knocked out all off-site electricity, helping to power the plant, because these things do not power themselves, they come off the grid. And loss of power can lead to a loss of cooling situation, which could lead to the equivalent of a Fukushima. Pilgrim has been shut down about 10 times since the beginning of 2015 for maintenance and weather-related causes, according to Neil Sheehan of the NRC. This is Pilgrim's second shutdown of the year, following a six-day outage in January after power lines that connect the plant to the electric grid failed during an earlier storm. Diane Turco, director of the group Cape Downwinders, said the failure of a transformer following the water heater leak and other breakdowns should alarm residents and regulators. She said, "It's not just one piece of equipment. It's multiple pieces of equipment, and that is something that could cause a core meltdown. And if that happens," she went on, "we lose all of eastern New England." The power station, which is not currently creating power, is scheduled to close permanently in May of 2019. In Vermont, Entergy, there's that name again, Entergy's expedited move of spent fuel from the Vermont Yankee spent fuel pool into concrete and steel storage and transportation casks has come to a screeching halt over concerns about possible problems with those casks. With 43 of 58 storage casks loaded and stored on the fuel storage pads, and 15 remaining to be loaded by the end of 2018 as a precondition of the planned sale of Vermont Yankee to North Star Services Group, shifting of the spent fuel stopped on March 10, when plant officials became aware of loose bolts on similar Holtec casks discovered at a nuclear plant. Now follow this one. Nuclear Regulatory Commission spokesmodel Neil Sheehan said two of the four-inch bolts had been found to have loosened, one at Holtec Fabrication Facility and another at the nuclear plant, which he declined to name. Oh, Neil, haven't you ever heard of Google? That plant you will not name is San Onofre. And the group SanOnofreSafety.org has been warning you about those casks for years. Joseph R. Lynch, Senior Manager of Government Affairs for Entergy, said, "Safety is Entergy's most important value, and at no time has the safety of Vermont Yankee staff or the community been implicated." But he then added, "The campaign is on track to be complete by the end of 2018," and said the company's focus continues to be the safe transfer of spent nuclear fuel from the pool by year's end. That's putting it on a timeline based on money, and does not address how long it will take to solve the problems with the casks. Turning now to Neil Sheehan of the NRC's nuclear reactor facility that shall not be named, Southern California Edison stopped loading spent nuclear fuel rods into canisters at San Onofre for about a week after discovering a design flaw in the new containers built for the nuclear waste. Right, like a week is long enough to forget about, not fix, a design flaw in a nuclear canister. Edison's chief nuclear officer, Tom Palmisano, revealed the problem at Edison's community engagement panel meeting in Laguna Hills on March 22nd. What happened is that Southern California Edison discovered a loose pin at the bottom of the canister. He said, "We directed the manufacturer to conduct extensive evaluations to ensure we have a comprehensive understanding of this change," which one activist at the event likened to asking the fox how things are going at the hen house. Edison has resumed loading fuel rod assemblies into canisters with the original design, which consists of only 5/8 of an inch of stainless steel in canisters only rated for 20 years, that now must hold radioactive waste that has a half-life of 24,000 years. Gary Hedrick of the group San Clemente Green spoke at the Citizens Engagement Panel meeting and expressed his concern about how experimental the process is and how fast Edison is moving forward with the process of moving waste. "Not like it's likely to go anywhere soon, we hope." And speaking of short-sightedness at San Onofre,
nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out a week.
At a time when we are receiving reports of American power plants across the country having their systems accessed by hackers, what is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission doing to protect us? They're removing cybersecurity from the San Onofre Nuclear Station. It may be shut down, but it is still, oh, so dangerous. All those spent, put spent in quotes, that's a spin-speak word, spent fuel rods still containing weapons-grade plutonium sitting around in a pool and in dry casks that are only 5/8 of an inch thick, and now we find out there's a design flaw in some of them? Well, the Union of Concerned Scientists are calling out the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Southern California Edison for their recent decision to remove enhanced cybersecurity systems at the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. According to Dr. Edwin Lyman, a nuclear scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, as he told NBC7 Investigates, it defies logic and it's not technically sound. Spent fuel remains dangerous as long as it's at the plant. It has to be protected. Cybersecurity is an essential element of that protection. And yet, San Onofre, meaning Southern California Edison, is moving forward with removing current cybersecurity systems that are already in place. Ya gotta save the money, ya know? Shareholder dividends are at stake. Ignore the safety to people and the environment. And keep calling those fuel rods spent as though they're empty, as opposed to still full of weapons-grade plutonium. Oh, but there, there, Missy, don't worry your pretty little head about it. The NRC says that if attackers attempted to sabotage the plant and cause a nuclear meltdown, workers would have about 10 hours to intervene and prevent this from happening. And that 10-hour cushion, put that in quotes, is one major reason why the NRC saw no problem in allowing Southern California Edison to drop their cybersecurity problem. Wow. 10 hours to prevent Armageddon. And with the traffic on the 405 freeway, it'll take at least that long for people to get to San Onofre, let alone save the world. And I hate to tell you this, but Bruce Willis is only an actor. So that's why Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Southern California Edison, who are risking our lives for a few pennies to each shareholder, you are both this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
One final note on San Onofre. The former Navy mayor of San Diego is asking top brass at Camp Pendleton to consider moving the spent fuel from San Onofre to a site on the base, further from the beach. Retired Admiral Len Herring said he believes the risks of storing the nuclear waste next to the ocean have not been correctly assessed. You think? Herring is part of a private group of scientists and nuclear experts who want to stop San Onofre's radioactive spent fuel rods from being buried in concrete bunkers next to the beach, approximately 50 miles north of downtown San Diego and 66 miles from Los Angeles. Herring said the group wrote to the current head of Marine Corps Installations West, Brigadier General Kevin Kilea, to consider moving the material to the east side of I-15, where it could be stored on a mesa on base well above the beach. Herring said, as sea level rises, the containers are subjected to elements that they simply are not designed to handle. That in itself should be a significant risk that is of concern to the citizens, but also to the Marine Corps and the Department of Defense, recognizing that, should there be a breach, Pendleton would basically be useless. The risks are significantly greater than we should have to endure. In Wisconsin, the company dismantling the Genoa nuclear facility spilled water laced with radioactive tritium into the Mississippi River. It happened last February, but it is not the first time that La Crosse Solutions, the company in charge of the $85 million project, made that mistake. The company accidentally spilled 400 gallons of radioactive water into the Mississippi River last year. Professor Jeff Bryan, who teaches nuclear chemistry at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, said, "This was a really dumb accident." In a brilliant display of doublethink, the NRC did not issue a citation, but found La Crosse Solutions violated policies that say any radioactive releases must be planned and controlled to keep the levels as low, quote, as reasonably achievable, end quote. Note that they don't say it has to be safe, NRC spokeswoman Victoria Mithling said, the bottom line is this. This was an unplanned release and it was unmonitored. This isn't something we want to see happen. In Washington state, at least 42 workers at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation are shown to have inhaled or ingested radioactive contamination from demolition of the nuclear reservation's plutonium finishing plant. The final results of worker tests after a December spread of contamination at the plant found 11 Hanford workers had inhaled or ingested radioactive particles. That's on top of the 31 positive test results after a similar spread of contamination in June at the plant at the center of the nuclear reservation. Radioactive contamination has been found outside worker offices at the plant and on worker cars and government vehicles. 7 workers' homes were checked for radioactive contamination, with none found. The Washington Department of Ecology, a regulator on the project, has said it will not allow demolition to continue if it is not convinced that the work can be done safely. If there's any good news with American nuclear reactors this week, it's that FirstEnergy Solutions is closing its nuclear power plants. These include the Davis-Bessey and Perry nuclear power plants in Ohio and Beaver Valley Power Station in Pennsylvania. A University of Hawaii study on radiation from Fukushima finds that the radiation deposited is 100 times higher than models had predicted. Yet because the levels are, quote, less than Fukushima Prefecture, end quote, the danger has been dismissed offhand. According to nuclear industry researchers who post under nukepro.net, it was really hard to find any real cancer statistics over time, especially in a chart form with a time horizontal axis. Providing actual data hinders the ability of the vested parties to control the narrative. We'll have a link up to the data from the University of Hawaii on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 354. Over to Japan, where the district court in Kyoto ordered the government and TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, the operators of the Fukushima nuclear plant, to pay a combined 110 million yen, approximately $1 million, to 110 evacuees who fled voluntarily after the 2011 nuclear disaster began. All of the 174 plaintiffs from 57 families had evacuated to Kyoto Prefecture without an evacuation order, except for one individual from Fukushima Prefecture. The district court ruling marks the fifth in a series of similar lawsuits brought across the nation. In all 5 cases, the respective courts acknowledged TEPCO's responsibility to pay damages to the plaintiffs. The Kyoto District Court's decision was the third to acknowledge the government's responsibility. The Fukushima food fight is continuing as the prefecture expects to export its rice to France. Fukushima Governor Masao Uchibori started his 4-day visit to France and Japan on March 22nd to promote local produce, including rice, beef, and processed fruit. Sources say the governor is also likely to cement a plan to increase Fukushima's shipments of rice to Britain. An official involved in Fukushima trade affairs says the exports will have, quote, a significant impact, yeah, end quote, as Britain and France play a central role in passing on information in Europe. Meanwhile, Hong Kong has declared that it will not lift its post-Fukushima ban on some Japanese foods. In the wake of the 2011 earthquake and nuclear disaster, Hong Kong banned the import of fresh produce and milk from the prefecture and the 4 neighboring prefectures while conducting targeted radiation testing on fresh produce from the rest of Japan. A statement by North Korea's leader Carrie Lam stated, "It is incumbent upon government to safeguard public health, and hence effective measures must be in place to ensure food safety and to maintain public confidence." Tell that to France and Britain. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, I want to thank all of you who contributed so generously to help me get to Harrisburg last week for the 39th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown. Regular listeners to this program know something of what that trip meant to me. and I could not have gone there without your support and especially the loving concern that was expressed, which helped keep me in the full upright position or as close to it as was possible. A full report on my experience there and some of the things I learned will be covered during next week's Nuclear Hot Seat special. But here's the thing. I'm still in shortfall on the expenses of the trip. So I'm asking again if you could help an activist out. And your assistance will not go unrewarded. If you are able to donate $20 or more, I'll send a facsimile copy of the article I wrote for LA Weekly from the evacuation point 39 years ago, an article that was published only 3 weeks after the accident. For $100 or more, I will send you that, plus an autographed copy of my upcoming book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and a Nuclear Hot Seat. It's currently on schedule to be published later this spring. And if you are so moved to send a $500 donation, you will get a personally dedicated and signed copy of the book, a signed 8x10 copy of the cover photo suitable for framing, and trust me, it is a picture you have never seen before because I've been holding it back. You will also receive a mention in the book as having helped me make this final chapter possible. Whatever you can do to help, please contribute through the website at nuclearhotseat.com. Yes, the big red donate button. If you have any problems there, email me and there is another solution. Know that by helping me to get to this event, you've helped me to change my life and by extension, have the opportunity to help others from that area do the same. And for that, I am truly and eternally grateful. Here's this week's featured interview. Joseph Mangano is a health researcher, an epidemiologist who has served as a director of Radiation and Public Health Project since 1989. Mangano is author or co-author of 33 medical journal articles on radiation health and is the author of the book Low-Level Radiation and Immune System Damage, An Atomic Era Legacy, and Radioactive Baby Teeth, The Cancer Link. He managed the study of strontium-90 in baby teeth and now manages the citizen-based radiation monitoring programs near the Indian Point, New York, and Oyster Creek, New Jersey, nuclear facilities.
Joe Mangano, always great to have you with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Likewise. Glad to be here.
First of all, let's give people an idea of your group. What is Radiation and Public Health Project, and how did it come to be?
We are a non-for-profit research and educational group. The truth is that we shouldn't even have existed in the first place had the nuclear industry and government been honest. When nuclear reactors were first built in the 1950s, there were several questions concerning the health of local residents. Number one, can we guarantee that there isn't going to be a major meltdown? Number two, how much radiation is going to be routinely released to the air? And number three, what are we going to do with the waste products produced in making electricity, but that it has to be kept safe for hundreds of thousands of years? What happened was the industry and government kind of colluded and just said, we're going to set some limits of safe limits, permissible limits, they call them. You know, if you release below a certain amount of radiation, or if the air and the water and the soil has below a certain amount, you're allowed to keep your license, you can keep running the reactor, and we call it safe. Now, we are a public health group. This isn't very good public health, all right? As a matter of fact, the radiation at low levels may be safe, but you got to do the studies. You've got to prove it. You can't just assume it. These are very dangerous chemicals we're talking about, the same that are created and released when atomic bombs explode. So just about 30 years ago, two retired gentlemen, one a physicist and the other a statistician, put together this group, and we have been at it ever since. 37 journal articles, 8 books, 57 or so op-eds. lots of media attention and so on. That's a bit of background of what we do.
What kind of information do you examine when you are coming up with your reports on what's going on around the nuclear reactor?
Two things. Dose and response are the formal names for them. By dose, we look at how much radiation is released from a reactor, how much exists in the local environment, the air and the water and the food and the body. We did a study measuring how much radiation were in the baby teeth of 5,000 children, most of them living near nuclear reactors. To date, this is the only study ever done looking at how much radiation is in the body of Americans living near reactors. And that's the dose side. The response side, very simply, is disease rates and death rates near nuclear plants, which our public health departments actually do a very fine job of collecting data and making them available on the web, both the state health departments and the Centers for Disease Control. That's what our work really has entailed. We haven't gotten to all reactors, but we've done studies near a number of them. And we find consistently that red flags are raised about unusually high levels of cancer and infant mortality and other disorders, especially after a nuclear plant opens.
Where do you find the numbers that you base your findings on?
The big one is the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. They haven't gone out and done studies near reactors, but they've done a fine job in collecting data. In fact, there are 50 years worth of statistics on mortality, on deaths in the United States, beginning in 1968. Right online, it has it by state, by county, by cause of death, by age, by gender, by race. It makes it rather easy for us to do a lot of analysis down to the county level. That's the major source that we use. And for the other side, the radiation side, how much is released and how much is in the environment, those come from the Environmental Protection Agency. Companies that run nuclear reactors are required to make these measurements every year and to report them.
What you've been working on is called epidemiology, and you're actually the reason that I have any familiarity at all with the term. It's the study and analysis of the distribution and determinants of health and disease conditions in defined populations. In other words, trying to work out why certain people in certain locations are getting ill. So let's take a look at some of the reactors that you have been studying. Let's start with Oyster Creek in New Jersey, which is scheduled to be closing in October of this year, 2018. How did that formerly low-cancer county rise to become a high-cancer county after the reactor started up?
Yeah, Libby, I hope we haven't scared anyone with a big word like epidemiology. Let's make it simple. These are basic questions like, what are cancer rates like near nuclear reactors like Oyster Creek? Very simple. Again, if it weren't for us and our group and our work, the answer would be, geez, we really don't know. Nobody does studies on this. Oyster Creek is a case in point. It is a reactor that is in central New Jersey. It's about 60 miles from New York City, and it's about 50 miles from Philadelphia. Obviously, lots and lots of people nearby. Strike two on Oyster Creek, it is the longest-running nuclear reactor in the United States, and I believe the world. The day it first started operating and generating radiation and emitting radiation was May 3rd, 1969. So we're coming in on 49 years here. Yes, even though reactors were supposed to go to 40 years at maximum. Point three with Oyster Creek is that even though the statistics on what was emitted from reactors are a little thin, unfortunately, the requirements are not very stiff. Because there are over 100 separate radioactive chemicals produced by reactors and emitted into the environment, a good system would be to make counts of each of them. There's only several that are counted. But one of them, iodine-131, We'll talk about it later. It's a chemical that affects the thyroid gland. It goes right, you know, when it's drank in the water and eaten in the food or breathed in, these little metal particles go right to the thyroid gland where it attacks and kills cells and leads to diseases like cancer. We found in the 70s and the 80s and the 1990s, Oyster Creek had the highest level of emissions than any U.S. reactor. Matter of fact, it had five times the amount that was officially released from the Three Mile Island partial meltdown, 1979.
And this was just part of its normal operating. It wasn't like they had an accident that happened there that created some radiation leak.
There was no meltdown. There was no shutdown by the government to saying that you're releasing too much. None of that. These were all part of normal operations.
How did that impact the cancer rates in the area?
Well, we took a look. We've actually been working on Oyster Creek for quite a while because our group is based in New York, and this is very close to New York City. We did a whole educational campaign, you know, in conjunction with local citizen groups. We even had a couple of celebrity supporters, Alec Baldwin and Christie Brinkley, and we went to that area of central New Jersey and gave a number of public talks. We collected 600 baby teeth from the area and found a high and rising amount of another chemical, strontium 90, which goes into teeth and to bone. As far as the cancer goes, there's been suspicions for a long time near Oyster Creek. Back in the 1990s, the health department, the state health department, found a childhood cancer cluster. And a very long story short, after about 10 years of meetings and discussion, no official cause of cancer was ever admitted to by the health department. In fact, they gave Oyster Creek, the nuclear component, very little attention at all. Years ago, when Oyster Creek first began operating, the cancer death rate in the county where it's located, Ocean County, was just below the New Jersey rate, 1% below. As the 1980s and 90s went along, it grew a couple of percent above the state rate, and in the 2000s, it was 8% higher. Now, going from 1% below to 8% above may not sound like very much, but let's turn it into real numbers and real people. If that original rate of 1% below the state had stayed, you know, all these past 49 years, there would have been over 2,500 fewer cancer deaths in this one county. Okay.
That's jaw-dropping.
That 2,500 is a lot of people. It's a very populated county. It's about 600,000 in the county. We also found, too, that the largest increases occurred in the youngest residents in the area. We know, you know, scientists agree, that while every human who is exposed to radiation is affected, the greatest harm is caused to the very youngest. That is the fetus, the infant, and the child. And we found that the childhood cancer rate years ago was 23% below New Jersey, and now it's risen to 15% above. Again, we're converting a low cancer county into a high cancer county. Are there other possible reasons? Sure, there might be, but we don't know of any. That would make this before and after switch like this, and we feel that there should have been more studies done. The health departments and the industry that ran the plant basically either ignored us or called our work. You know, they'll use terms like junk science. Do they have any proof that Oyster Creek is safe? Nope, not one.
Given that this situation was found around Oyster Creek, are there other reactors where similar patterns have been found and where populations are suffering from similar consequences?
Oh, sure. I could give you several, but the one I'll focus on is the other nuclear plant in New Jersey, and that's called Salem Hope Creek. It's a little different than Oyster Creek. Oyster Creek has one reactor. Salem Hope Creek has three. Oyster Creek is relatively small. Salem not only has three reactors, but each is about double the capacity of Oyster Creek. This is a big place. The reactors came online later than Oyster Creek, from the mid-70s to the mid-80s. Okay, so we did a similar study of Salem County, where this reactor is located. A little bit different. Oyster Creek is 600,000 people. Salem only has about 65,000 people. It's largely rural. Farming is the primary industry, if you will, which should mean that there's no real worry about industrial pollution in the area. So let's go back. As the reactors were opening in the mid-1980s, the Salem County cancer death rate, just like Oyster Creek, was 5% below the rest of New Jersey. Now, in this decade, that 5% below the state has turned into 20% above the state.
That's a 25% change.
A 25% flip. And it, once again, it is highest in children, in young adults, and in middle-aged adults, like we would have expected if nuclear emissions were a factor. We even found that there was a jump in death rates for causes other than cancer, all right, from 2% higher to 23% higher. And once again, we'll go to the what we call the excess cancer cases. Since the mid-80s, we estimate that over 1,000 people died because these rates went up. All right, if they had stayed where they were back in the mid-80s and continued for the last 30 years, over 1,000 fewer people would have died in this one small county.
So we're getting a pretty clear picture that nuclear reactors under normal operating conditions create problems and have emissions and, according to the epidemiology, impact cancer rates and leads to an increase in them. But let's look now at what happens when there has been what the nuclear industry once upon a time assured us would never happen, which is an accident, meaning Three Mile Island. And the nuclear industry is fond of saying nobody died at Three Mile Island. Now there is a Facebook-based group, Three Mile Island Survivors, that has over 4,000 members who identify with that label. And these individuals claim a wide range of health impact from that nuclear partial meltdown in 1979. And there are reports of a large number of deaths and illnesses within their own families and communities. What does the epidemiology tell us about what really happened as a result of the accident at Three Mile Island?
I'll start my answer by repeating what I said a few minutes ago, and that is the nuclear industry grabbed that slogan, nobody died at Three Mile Island, almost immediately after the meltdown occurred. Before there had been any chance to measure how much radiation was released, how much actually got into the water and the food and people's bodies and so on. It was an immediate attempt to stifle any type of research. Even though I consider myself a health researcher and a non-political one, we all understand that this is a very, very highly politicized area. And the example I'll give before we get into our results involves two groups. The first group was some researchers from Columbia University in New York. They got some funding from a group that was commissioned by a judge after the Three Mile accident. Their mission was to go and do some research on whether or not there was a connection between the radiation released from Three Mile and cancer in the local area. Very simply, their answer was no, there was no association. And they published an article in the American Journal of Public Health. I mean, these are, again, Columbia is a highly reputed university, and these are all, you know, PhDs and physicians and so on. And they gave, in the articles, they gave the data that they used. Well, along comes a group from the University of North Carolina School of Public Health, which I happen to be a graduate of, headed by a gentleman, Dr. Stephen Wing, working with a group of his colleagues. Wing and the UNC people took the same data that the Columbia people used and came to a different conclusion. They only looked at lung cancer and leukemia within the 10-mile radius around Three Mile Island, and they found a high increase. As a matter of fact, it's amazing to me that Columbia came to that conclusion of no link, because if you look at the number of cancers of people living within 10 miles of Three Mile Island, and you compared 5 years before and after the meltdown, the number of cancers went up 60%, from 1,700-something to 2,800-something. Now, you don't need a Ph.D. in epidemiology. You don't need an M.D. from Columbia or UNC to say, whoa, wait a minute, is this normally what happens in an area where our cancer is going up 60%? The answer, of course, is no. And what happened after that was essentially a fight that broke out in the medical journals. The Columbia people were agitated and called the UNC group, you know, politically motivated and all this stuff. And UNC just responded with explaining how they came up with this. Once again, I'm trying not to be political, but this is one of the better examples of how highly politicized this is. The establishment does not want to admit to one death. No one died at Three Mile Island, because that means there's a lot of other people that may be suffering and dying as well.
And that's why this Facebook group got started. I believe it's following in the steps of North St. Louis and the Just Moms there with what yes. they've been able to create by growing the awareness. Let's move this ahead. You told me that you're looking into an analysis of cancer deaths in Burke County, Georgia, which is the site of the Bogle plant where they're trying to build two new reactors and coming into all kinds of problems. But do they have nuclear fuel on site yet? Are there radioactive fuel rods there? Or is there some other cause for the difficulty that people are facing?
This is Burke County, Georgia. Now, it is a county that sits on the border with South Carolina. And the border actually is the Savannah River. We need to give a little history here. Right across the river from Burke County, Georgia, lies the Savannah River plant. The Savannah River plant was built way, way back in 1949. It formerly was a mostly farming, rural area. This was not a nuclear power reactor, but it was a series of reactors that helped make nuclear weapons. At that time, of course, it was the Cold War, and the U.S. and the Soviet Union were engaged in a frantic race to build as many nuclear weapons as possible. And Savannah River played a major, major role in making these bombs. Of course, now it is no longer making weapons. We've stopped that when the Cold War ended in the early 90s. It's a large area, and it is highly contaminated, one of the most contaminated areas in the United States. And it's been cleaned up now for 20 years, and they're going to be at it for a very long time. So let's start there. Right across the river is Burke County, Georgia. A nuclear reactor has to be on a body of water, because essentially the way a nuclear reactor makes electricity is to heat water up. Somebody called it a very dangerous and expensive way to boil water. The Savannah River is a large, wide river at that point. It flows into the Atlantic Ocean. In the late 1980s, two nuclear power plants, power reactors, were built in Burke County. And they were called Vogel 1 and Vogel 2. They wanted a Vogel 3 and 4, but like many proposed reactors, they were canceled, essentially because they were expensive. But, of course, I always say that, why are the reactors expensive? It takes a lot of money to build such dangerous machines. Burke County, again, is like across in South Carolina. It's a rural county. It's got about 23,000 people. Slightly over half are African American. The poverty rate is very high in Burke County, always has been. Okay, the unemployment rate is high. The proportion of inadequate housing is high. All the standard measures of poverty occur in Burke County. It's a poor county, all right? The idea of building these reactors in a formerly pristine area, of course, raises the question, did it do anything to the health of local residents? Well, Once again, you go back to the CDC website and look at what happened. In the 1970s, before the reactors opened, the black cancer mortality rate was 29% below the rest of Georgia. And that makes sense because we don't expect a lot of cancer in rural areas. We expect cancer, you know, in areas where there are coal mines or in big cities with a lot of industrial emissions and so on. That number of 29% below now in the last decade is 15% above. And these are for blacks. Whites had an increase, too, in Burke County. Years ago, they were 1% below and now 12% above. Again, the poverty rates are considerably higher for blacks in Burke County than they are for whites.
So what you're saying is that the radiation that is impacting the health of the people in Burke County actually comes from the other side of the river and this previous facility.
Well, previously, some of it did. More of it in the Savannah River plant in South Carolina. More of it stayed in South Carolina, although some got to Georgia. Still, the cancer rate was below average. All right, it wasn't until they built those two nuclear reactors in Burke County, in Georgia, right there, when the cancer rates began to change from below average to well above average.
And for the sake of clarity, we know that there are two new reactors that are under construction, but are there other reactors that are on the site of Vogtle that are in operation and have been?
The answer to both your questions are yes and yes. The ones that began operating in the late 80s continue to operate, even though they're getting older and corroding and leaking and so on. But in the, I guess about 10, 15 years ago, there was an effort to build new reactors. Building had stopped, essentially. The last approvals for reactors were in the late 70s because the people that financed it, you know, the Wall Street people, understood it to be very expensive and very dangerous. So this nuclear renaissance, as they called it, began. And there was a lot of discussion in Washington, and they did after years and years was, I think the number was $15 billion, not to help build reactors, but in case a new reactor was built and they had to stop, that the builders would get their money back. There was a number of reactors that were proposed, like 20 of them. Almost every one pulled out. They said, you know what? We can't do this. This is going to take years and years to build these things. It's going to take a heck of a lot of money. We've got new types and safer types of energy like solar and wind, forget it. An exception was the Vogtle plant, where reactors 3 and 4 were not completely built, but the building process began, I believe it was about 8 years ago. And there have been all these promises about when they're going to be finished and how much it would cost. Well, guess what? As the years go on, the expected year of opening keeps getting pushed further in the future, and of course the bill gets bigger and bigger. Right now, the construction is only about one-third done, and this is after about eight or ten years. That's very slow. That means it's going to take 20, 25 years or more to finish these things and an ungodly amount of money. There is a very strong citizen-based effort to stop the construction, and there's a lot of people who believe that these two reactors will never operate. And of course, part of it is the idea of environmental injustice or racial injustice in this case, that you're picking on a very poor area with a large proportion of African Americans and putting these dangerous reactors, more of these dangerous reactors there.
That was health researcher Joseph Mangano of Radiation and Public Health Project. You can read more about his important work at radiation.org. Activist shout out! This April 10, next Tuesday, is the 5th annual Becquerel Awareness Day, an educational event sponsored by the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, which you can find on Facebook. The date was chosen because of its proximity to Nuclear Meltdown Alley. Think March 11 for Fukushima, March 28th for Three Mile Island, and April 26th for Chernobyl. This April 10th, Becquerel Awareness Day will feature special guests in a campaign geared to highlight fans' petition, No Olympics or Paralympics in Radioactive Fukushima. Yes, you heard that right. Baseball, softball, and soccer games for young athletes from around the world are planned to be held approximately 12 miles from the still-leaking Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster site. And it's going to happen if they have their way in just a little over 2 years from now. And did you hear? Surfing has been officially added for the first time ever as an Olympic sport. That's the good news. But the bad news is that the competitions are planned for further down the coast at Chiba, which is still considered so radioactive that several Asian countries ban all seafood and some produce from that area. You cannot make this stuff up. So we invite you to learn more. Visit Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network's website, ffan.us, and their Facebook page, Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, where you are invited to like and share the Becquerel Awareness Day, April 10 information. Here's this week's final thought. Nobody died at Three Mile Island. How often have we heard that line? How often have we said it, word for word, parroting the message of the nuclear industry? But as you just heard from Joseph Mangano, it was announced almost immediately following the accident, when no one could possibly know the impact of the radiation releases. It was announced as a means of cutting off investigation, research, follow-up, and the possible unveiling of the truth about what really happens when a nuclear reactor has a serious radiation-releasing accident. What I came to realize while at Three Mile Island last week is that, in essence, that statement from the nuclear industry is technically correct. Nobody died at Three Mile Island. But look at that preposition, at. It's a primary example of nuclear spin speak. That's where the lie lives, hidden in a subtle truth. Because it is true. Nobody died at the Three Mile Island nuclear generating station located on Three Mile Island in Londonderry Township, Pennsylvania, on the Susquehanna River just south of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Nobody died at the site. Nobody dropped dead at or on the nuclear facility before, during, or after the accident of March 28th through 30th, 1979. However, have people died from the accident at Three Mile Island? Hell yes. People have died and are still dying from the radiation releases, the lack of medical investigation, the lack of medical care, the genetic damage passed down to children and now grandchildren and whatever kids they might grow up to have. Of all the instances I have discovered of nuclear spin speak, the lies hidden, cleverly hidden, wickedly hidden, in the nuclear industry's intentional semantic manipulations, this one to me is the most heinous, because it has become so embedded in our thinking, in our languaging, and has done so much long-term harm already. I will have a full report about this on next week's show, number 355. In the meantime, let's all change our languaging, shall we? People did die from Three Mile Island, and they're still dying. And the harm that nuclear meltdown did will never go away. Tune in next week to find out more. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 3rd, 2018. Material from this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, miningawareness.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear, bostonglobe.com, recorder.com, kpbs.org, LaCrosseTribune.com, Fox8.com, SeattleTimes.com, NukePro.net, QZ.com, Asahi.com, NHK.OR.JP, SEMP.com, VancouverSun.com, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And here's a big shout out to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world, 123 countries on six continents and counting, plus everyone who's listening on our growing network of broadcast stations in the U.S. You, yes, you, are the ones who show your love for life on this planet by being the kick-ass defenders of nuclear truth and supporters of atomic awareness that you are. Thank you so much for visiting the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat blog page. We've also got a podcast page. Don't ask me how we got two. Somebody did that for me. But go to the blog page. And if you haven't yet, be sure to click like, click follow, and then feel free to post and share. And to find our back episodes, all 353 of them. Sometimes I can't even believe that number, but it's true. 353 episodes. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. You can search by date. You can search by number of the episode. And now there is a new feature that if you put in nuclearhotseat.com/blog, you will be able to scan back about 10 episodes at a time. That's 2.5 months at a time. So you can always catch up with anything you may have fallen behind on. While we're at it, theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompaniment by John Barnard, recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. Never miss a new episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. Have it delivered by email every week. It's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the yellow box, and sign up. As a bonus, you will receive a free sample chapter from my upcoming book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and a Nuclear Hot Seat. The part you'll get is the chapter of me on the ground, 1 mile away from the nuclear reactor, when the loudspeaker comes down the middle of the road announcing the end of my life as I knew it. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2018, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We even have a recurring $5 donation button. Once a month, $5. Same as buying a cup of coffee for the show, but we won't be drinking any coffee. Whatever you can do, know it supports the show, it supports me, and I am grateful. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating. Once again, reminding you that radioactive nuclear waste is forever. No one is immune to its impact on their health and safety. The nuclear industry has no way of safely storing or neutralizing it, and they're still creating more every day. There, you have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So please, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.